Hey gang, welcome to the show, National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org. Go there, click on the donate button, send money. Let's keep this network going. Go to nationalbugle.com, read the articles, but don't forget to download the Co-Certified app. It's $2.95. It's a great deal. Lots of fun. Today, I have for you an interview I did on a South American podcast called State of the Americas. So let's take a listen to that.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another State of the Americas. Today, we are having none other than Dr. Patrick Slattery himself. As you may know, he is the co-host for This Week on the Alt-Right, which is the Mark Les show on YouTube on his channel. And also, he is a co-host and I believe you are the right-hand man for Dr. David Duke as well.
Yeah, that's what the Southern Poverty Law Center calls me, so I guess I am.
Right. And also, you also have a show, which is National Bugle Radio, and also you're doing a show in Storefront Radio, am I correct?
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of radio, yeah.
Okay, so today the topic is going to be on subverting a political system, which is going to be not only a political system, but also the electoral system itself. And this is going to be a very fascinating topic because not many know that Dr. Slattery is actually a PhD in political science. So this is going to be, we are going to try to go as much in depth as the political science allow us to do. And also, of course, we are going to tie this with a little bit of history so we can make a much broader understanding of how this actually works and how the things got to the point that where they are now. So, okay, good doctor. Hello. And
thank you for having me on. It's a honor to be on with you and talking to your audience.
Oh, the honor is absolutely mine because I have been listening to your show ever since I saw you debating Halsey Judish and on the Race World Keys channel. It was that was epic. And I remember that specific live stream actually got deleted by YouTube.
It got deleted very promptly, and you know there was no hate speech on there. It was a very civil conversation, and there were, you know, no bad words were used. So they simply, the only motivation they would have had to take it down, because there was no hate speech in it. It was simply that we won the debate. Mark and I won the debate, and
yeah. That's yeah, absolutely. I mean, you crushed those guys, and not only that. That's also when you have the four initial minutes of Eric Stryker making his remarks on free speech and all that, and that was basically how me as a South American got introduced to the work that all of you guys were doing. It was one hell of a show, actually.
Well, the background to that was that Mark Collett had arranged a debate with Halsey English and one other person. His name slips my mind for the time being, but it was supposed to be with Mark Collett and David Duke doing the debating. Well, David Duke had some emergency that came up at the last minute, and so the arrangement was for Eric Stryker to be his replacement. Well, Halsey English, I guess he had done a lot of research on David Duke and thought he could trip him up with KKK allegations and whatnot. And he didn't think he was going to. Well, I guess he knew who Eric Stryker was and was afraid to debate him, and so refused. Andy Worski let Eric Stryker have a few minutes to make a statement, and Halsey English apparently didn't know who I was, so he agreed for me to be a fill-in. I was a last-minute fill-in. I didn't know I was going to be doing this until about just 5 minutes or so before it started, but it all worked out well.
Yeah, definitely. I remember that because, yeah, Yeah, his excuse was that he didn't want to debate Eric Strager without McGinnell, because you know he's someone that goes for the personal attacks from the family attacks and all these kind of things. It's very disingenuous and very ad hominem, you know, strawmanning, all these kind of things, you know, kvetching. Yeah, the issue with Mark and you, it was much more intellectual discussion, and these people were not prepared to that point, to that yeah, to a type of specific debate, because you are an academic and Mark is also has a background
Mark,
in political science. I believe he has or
well,
something. He's an
he's a
academic.
very good debater too. He has specifically,
Yeah.
debating skills.
Yeah, also he had he did have practice previously, you know, debating other groups of people when he was in the BNP and all during his career. So,
Yeah, and
you know, husband was just another fly in front of
yeah,
the road.
and a year ago or so, the blood sports, the internet blood sports, was a big fad, and Mark Collett had engaged in a fair amount of it. I don't know. It just all of a sudden became a thing, and it doesn't seem to be that much of a thing anymore. But he was all in the middle of it. That was the only time I engaged in a an online debate. But it all worked out
Yeah,
fine.
definitely.
Yeah.
I believe a lot of the audience of Worski actually got exposed to these ideas that there could be something else to what you guys were saying, and there could be something else to what the media is saying. You know, it's that it's a part of a whole dichotomy for them. So that it was, I believe, it was very productive. And okay, but in any case, I wanted to ask you, good doctor. When did you begin to noticing this type of issues, this type of people?
Well, if you're talking about
Or
the Jewish power in the United States
mm-hmm.
in particular, in the world in general, it was a slow process. I remember the 1973 Yom Kippur War between Israel on the one hand and Egypt and Syria on the other, 1973. And I re remember remarking to my parents, because we were watching it on the news, that, oh, because my parents did not, well, they somebody must have said something not supportive of Israel. And so picking up on it, I said something like, oh, well, the American government's only supporting Israel because of its oil. And my father said, no, it's the other countries that have the oil. And I thought, really? Well, why support Israel? I remember, I don't know, it was a very gradual process. In the 1980s, I remember hearing from Arabs. I knew some Arab Americans who told me that if they donated money to, Teddy Kennedy or to a politician, that the money would be returned. That politicians did not want to receive donations from Arab Americans. They would receive lots of donations from Jews, lots, but not from Arabs. So there were some little indicators, little things. And of course, in the 1980s, the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, and their massacre of Palestinians in refugee camps. There just didn't seem to be any good reason for all of the politicians, practically all of the politicians, to be so pro-Israel. So I approached it from that end, from the more of the Palestinian solidarity end. I didn't realize how much they controlled other aspects, or they dominated other aspects of American society. And it really, I guess, it was in the early 1990s that when I was in my PhD course, and I started realizing that half of my teachers were Jewish, and half of the teachers in the political science department were Jewish, and that the Jewish teachers in particular were assigning they were assigning books and readings by other Jews. They were more likely to assign other Jews, you know, promote the work of other Jews. I didn't used to be able to tell the difference between Jews and non-Jewish whites, but I started making a point of it and studying what kinds of names were Jewish. And of course, this was before the internet was very prevalent, so it mm-hmm. wasn't as easy to study these things. I listened to shortwave radio. There were some shortwave radio programs that discussed these issues, and read a book by the guy's Eustace Mullins, who has a lot. He had a lot of strange ideas, but I gradually came to realize that wow, Jews dominate American politics in a way that went beyond Middle Eastern policy or beyond foreign policy, but was really quite extensive. But it was a slow awakening. It was a slow awakening, and it wasn't until I actually, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I started listening to David Duke's weekly. He used to put up every week a video, and they were very enlightening. And finally, when I got to know him and I started talking to him, I realized it wasn't just that Jews were trying to dominate the United States, but they were really trying to specifically replace non-Jewish whites, that they had a particular grudge against non-Jewish whites. And that helped me understand, the immigration issue and many other issues. So that it was a long, slow process, a process of decades. And so when I meet young people who are very aware of what's going on, I think, wow, they learned a lot faster than I did. It took me decades to learn this. So I know that was a long answer, but that was how I came to be aware of these things.
No, actually, it was a necessary answer, because this also makes a, like, it shows us that the big gap between the generations, you know, because your generation had a different approach to these things, had a different approach to these people, how they behaved, they didn't notice, because, you know, the brainwashing was already happening, you know, like you were saying, because your teachers were already giving you, things to read, but written by their people, mm-hmm. in order to their ideas, you know. So they became, in the words of Dr. Michael Jones, a Judaization of different people, of the mindset. So it's very interesting, because they continue to do that up to this day. You know, even in my country they do that, but in a much minor way. But they do it in any case. But all the other people that right now are, like you were saying, that have awakened to this question, are mainly because of the internet, because of the way they interact with things, and they notice, and things go viral, and so it's like a thunderbolt. It's like a thunderbolt that it just breaks the sky and crushes the land, and it's in front of you, and you see, it's like, wow, really? And it changes you. You know, that experience changes you, in my opinion. Because, for example, in my case was a little bit different, because there was this very normie YouTuber that make videos about conspiracies, about horror, about things on the internet, things of 4chan and so on. And he made a video about the 9/11 thing, and he made a video that the guy that profited from all of this death was a man named Larry Silverstein. Mm-hmm. So I decided to research who this guy was, and maybe I was 16 or 17 or something like that at that time. And I looked at him, and he, you know, you can just see by seeing his face, I knew which type of man he was. So I decided to do a little more digging on the guy, and you know, I did what the guy was. Just as I expected, total crook, a total piece of shit, a total douchebag. And It wasn't just that, because I started to go into forums, and people were talking about things like allergy plan, anemia plan, different things, the different conspiracies, the conspiracy for the assassination of JFK. And I saw Gaddafi video that said, Israel actually killed JFK. And it was just, like you're saying, it's a total different process. It was just like I threw myself to a swimming pool without knowing how to swim, and I just had to figure it out by myself. So it was a very interesting process for me. It was it, maybe, and that was maybe 10 years. Yeah, maybe like 10 years ago, something like that. I can't remember exactly what age I was at that moment, but I recall that was what changed my path. So yeah, in any case, I wanted to go back then to going back to you is that I wanted to ask you another thing, which is, okay, since you began noticing these things, since you began your red pilling process, also, what did you first do when that happened? Who did you contact people? Did you do research? Did research on yourself and via the access the to the academia that you already had? What did you do in order to answer these things?
So, when I guess the real red pill, there's maybe two aspects to it. One is understanding how much power that they have. That certainly, if you're in the United States, they dominate the United States. And maybe if you're in Peru, they might not directly dominate Peru, but Latin America is under the shadow of the United States, and the United States is dominated by Jewish power. So you realize their power, but then you also realize you're not allowed to talk about it. And these two things, you realize these simultaneously, they're two sides to the same coin. So when I started really looking into it, I had various hints before that in the 70s and the 80s, various hints. But when I really started looking into it was before the internet was, it was just, I guess it was really before the World Wide Web had become a thing. And so I was listening to shortwave. I was listening to, or I was getting books through interlibrary loans and whatnot. The people I was more likely to talk to, especially after 9/11 and the wars started, well, that created a peace movement, and the peace movement was against American wars in the Middle East. Well, you would have a variety of people would come to these demonstrations, and you would have Arabs and Arabs in general, Palestinians in particular. And the Palestinians, well, you could talk to them about Israeli power for sure, and you might be able to feel comfortable talking to a Palestinian about Jewish power. And I remember a Palestinian talking to me about David Duke, and I knew the name, and I just said, because he was saying, yes, David Duke says this and that, and I said, yeah, well, that's all. If everything he's saying is correct, but you can't talk about David Duke in America. I was warning him, you can't talk about it. So there are Palestinian solidarity committees. These are tend to be leftist groups. There are a lot of them in universities, and so that was one avenue. But again, it was more of a. Thank you. again, it was more of a anti-Zionist in terms of Israel. It was like narrowly focused on Israel, and these organizations are easily captured by Chomsky, Noam Chomsky followers, Chomskyites, because the whole, the Chomsky paradigm is that, yes, Israel does horrible things. Israel is an apartheid state, but Israel is basically a tool of American imperialism, American corporate power. And so the ultimate blame gets deflected back to America. And, by implication to these white, waspy white Eastern elite that dominates American business and the American industrial, military industrial complex. And of course, that's not the truth. The truth is that it's a there's a the older elite, the Anglo elite, has been decades ago. It was basically taken over and replaced by a Jewish-centered elite. And so, to the extent that I don't think Israel really, I think Israel acts very independent even of the American Jewish elite. But to the extent that Israel does anything as an American puppet, it's doing it as a puppet of a Zionist America. But really, I think Israel acts very independently of the American Jewish elite. That the American Jewish elite tends to be more supportive of Israel than the other way around, and sometimes Israel goes too far, and the American Jewish elite, sometimes is trying to rein it in. I think that's more typically what happens. I hope that helped answer your question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's true what you're saying, because remember that China and Israel were coming too close together, and that actually reflected badly on the side of the Jewish Americans, because they supposedly they didn't want the communism and all this kind of stuff. It's kind of garbage. At the end of the day, business is business, you know. And to these people, it's no different, whether it would be with the Chinese or the Russians or anyone else, because time and time again that has proven to be the case.
Yeah, there was
But
a book written by a Harvard law professor. I think he's moved to Columbia University since then. His name was Noah, what was it? Noah Feldman. And he was a very high profile professor at Harvard University. And the name of the book was The Cool War. And it was basically proposing a kind of a Cold War between the United States and China. And so, yeah, you're right. There's been a lot of contact between Israel and China. Israel has helped get China some technology that America would share with Israel but would not share with China. But American Jews aren't necessarily that pro-Chinese. And I think American Jews are happy to have boogeymen, enemies, first and foremost, Russia or Arabs, but I think they're happy to have China also as a potential enemy and an excuse for American military bases in Asia. And I also think that the international Jewish elite, not so much the Israelis, but the international Jewish elite, likes to have conflict between China and, on the one hand, and then South Korea or Japan on the other hand.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree to that. And also, let's remember this guy, Henry Kissinger. He has a book dedicated to China. The name of his book is actually China. No, it's that simple. There are people trying to pull the string of the turning the gears from one place to another. You know, they are trying to do to set up Plan B, because there is just a lot of people that have been waking up to these questions, and they just seem to maybe some days at some moment they are going to snap just like this. And that's what they, because of that, they are trying to present a plan B or even a plan C. Because the other question that tie all this together with us is that they are too much interested in Patagonia, to a point where it's like a religious experience or something like that. It's weird. It's very weird. And I remember me and an Argentinian guy talked to Dr. Duke about this issue, and that they do go over there and they do studies of the chemicals that are nearby, or the minerals, or the soil itself. They make all these things, or the geography, or the site, the geology. It's like they make too much study to that. It's even obsessive, you know. It's outstanding, but not outstanding in the good way, but in the really bad way. Like, what the heck, man? You get me,
Yeah,
Doug.
and
You get Doug.
Adrian Salbucci, he's used to come on David Duke's show frequently. He stopped coming on because of scheduling conflicts, but he used to inform us a great deal about the Israeli penetration into Patagonia, and of course there's a long history to that, which you probably know better than I do.
Because the guy that conceived Zionism talked about that they wanted a state either in Israel or, you know, in Palestine, because he himself said in Palestine, or in Patagonia. And that's the main reason, you know. And because a lot of people are also saying that if they really, really want that tomorrow, they are going to make a.
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
in Patagonia, and that's the main reason, you know. And because a lot of people are always saying, are also saying that if they really, really want that tomorrow, they are going to make a. They're going to make an excuse, you know, like in some sacred text, that there were some coordinates, and that those coordinates are Patagonia, so Patagonia is the second promised land. So it's to these people is just that they will find the excuse to make that happen. But if this happens, the issue with my people, the Peruvians, is that because we are friends with the Argentinians, it's like we are not going to allow that to happen. And this is going to be the Middle East Middle East situation once again, but in a different place. But it's going to be the same thing. We are going to kick their asses. They are not going to let that happen. And you know, the Americans are going to get involved. And it's just the whole 9 years, in a way, of saying that.
Mm. Well, it's amazing that the Jewish people have had this identity and have maintained a great deal of ethnic cohesion for thousands of years, all the time wandering from one area to another. So, yeah, they have their origins in the Middle East, but, you know, the 2000... or so, well, even before 2,000 years ago, they were moving around the Middle East into the Babylonia, Egypt, and then, of course...
Persia.
Yeah, and Persia, and then later into Europe and, you know, Eastern Europe, into Spain, into Turkey, North Africa, and all the while maintaining their identity. And then more recently into the United States and that they are, it is, when you think of that history, it's extremely conceivable that, okay, 50 years from now, would there be large numbers in Patagonia? 100 years from now, or 50 years from now, would there be a Jewish state in Patagonia? If it was any other people on Earth, you would say, well, that sounds like fantasy. But the Jews have shown that, you know, they certainly are willing to move from country to country to country, and now they do have the power where they could even, you know, if they could set up a state in Palestine, they could set up a state in somewhere else in the world, whether it's in Patagonia or who knows, Miami Beach. I don't know.
Madagascar.
The poor lemurs. Oh, Yvay, the lemurs.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, talking about that, let me show you one thing. I bought this book not so long ago. It's called Being Jewish in Peru. It's written by Jews themselves, and what they say is something very important over here. They explain how they maintain their identity. Let me see if there are some notes over here. Which one was? Oh, yeah. Here, they say that what happens is that when they move to another place, they establish two things. One is a cemetery,
mm-hmm,
in order to bury their dead. And the second thing is that they establish a synagogue, mm-hmm, and the synagogue is the cultural power, the place where they spread all the tales, all the folks, all the things that they have to offer to their people, and you know that's how the mindset continues. But for example, here in Peru, at very least, what happened was that they couldn't. They got a cemetery. It wasn't theirs. It was a British cemetery, you know, a piece of the British cemetery. They got access to that, and they started to bury their dead over there. But they couldn't make a synagogue because of different things, because they tried to make that, and there was an earthquake that happened, so they couldn't continue. They had to rebuild. They didn't have money, so a lot of them actually got assimilated and Nobody knows where they are right now. And the other group, the second wave that came, according to this book, said that they came and they make a they instead of making a synagogue, they made a school, and within the school they continued their tradition. That's how they also started to dig some of the documents of the first Jewish migration that happened. And also, it's kind of funny because we do have two Jewish national heroes, and you wouldn't expect that, because they are actually outstanding. They were actually outstanding soldiers. It's like very, very weird. It's like they are very weird because they got kicked. Yeah, they got their ass kicked at the war against Chile. And they just decided to come back, even after they got their ass kicked, and they decided to come back and continue to fight against the Chileans, and most of them died actually. And there is this guy that, he got a bullet to his arm. He couldn't move his arm, and that didn't stop him from fighting until the very end. And for us, it's easier to point out to these people and say, if you are of this ethnicity, but you behave like Winston Churchill instead of this guy, we don't want you here. You do not belong here. Maybe you should move out.
Yeah.
So that's a proxy on how we can change this issue for us, but that's a very specific case scenario for us. But also, talking about going back to you and to Dr. Duke. Here is someone from the chat that asked about Eustace Mullins, because he said that one time Eustace Mullins was questioned about Dr. Duke, and do you know if him and Dr. Duke had any interaction, any correspondence or something?
I bet they did, because Dr. Duke has been prominent in this movement for so long, so I'm sure they have. I couldn't say exactly what it is, but I'm sure they spoke to each other at some point.
Interesting, interesting. But okay, and going back to our main topic, which is what brings us here today, I wanted to ask you, since you have a background in academia, yeah, in the academia, and in political science more specifically, according to the political theory and political science, does the United States work as it should work, or is there something rigged at some point in the system itself?
Okay, could you hold on just 1 second, please?
Okay. Yeah, no worries.
Okay, okay. What's up? Okay.
Don't worry, my friends. He will come back
Okay.
just in a minute.
All right. All right. Right. Okay,
Okay.
so sorry about that.
Okay.
So, the I mean, obviously the political system's not working the way it's supposed to. Of course, the probably the a separate problem that might be even bigger is that so many people still don't understand that it's not working. And also those who do understand that it's not working don't necessarily have the right idea. They don't understand why it's not working. So, any political system is difficult. And, Winston Churchill, who's not a hero of mine, but he is somebody who is very quotable. He says interesting things that you can quote, but he is said to have made the comment that democracy is the worst possible form of government, except for every other form of government. And the idea being that the governments typically leave a lot to be desired. So our government was set up very, it didn't just fall into place. It didn't just, many systems have, were monarchies and they had kings and this and that. There was a very definite departure point for the United States at the beginning, writing a constitution, and with the people who were writing the constitution were studying history. They were studying what happened to Rome. They were studying Switzerland. They were studying any example they could to try to come up with a system that would really work for the people, for the people of the United States. And you know, they in some ways they succeeded, in some ways they failed, but it worked well enough. It worked well enough that the United States became the most powerful country on earth. So, you know, that is some measure of success. Of course, what we've seen, and I'm sure there was always problems. There was always problems, but what we've seen is a rise of Jewish power, and it's hard to say exactly when it started. You know, because even before the United States became its own republic, you had you mentioned earlier, you know, the first thing that you'll find when Jews come to an area is they make a cemetery and a synagogue. Well, if you look at the list of the oldest synagogues in the United States, and you could do it for South America too, it would work in South America, you'll see a very close correspondence to where these synagogues are. I'm looking at a list right now. Well, New York City, that's not a surprise, but Newport, Rhode Island, Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina. Well, what is it about Newport, Rhode Island, Savannah, Georgia, and Charleston, South Carolina? Well, they were all slave trading centers, you know. And if you were to do the same in Brazil, do the same in the Caribbean, you'd find the same thing, that where you had slave trading centers, you had synagogues. So they've always had a certain penetration into the United States, but it's really in the late 1800s when you had large numbers of the Ashkenazi Jews, the Eastern European Jews, who migrated to the United States. Most of them were poor, but there was a lot who had money, and they all had an ethnic identity and ethnic solidarity, and they tended to work towards similar goals. And in short order, they started to become very important in some very important fields. So you think of Joseph Pulitzer, who was a newspaper publisher, a very big deal. They started penetrating into the press very early on in the late 1800s. They were penetrating into banking, and so there's, you know, the Schiff family. Obviously, the Rothschild family. You had these banking families, and so they be before World War One. Before World War One, you already had a great deal of Jewish power in banking and in the media. In when we say the media, not just newspapers. You look at music, for instance, music publishing, even before the record player, even before, you know, that, just music publishing and theater, vaudeville. And they got involved in advertising. They got involved in many things, and they got into academia. And so even before World War One, they had enough power that you can make a plausible argument that the United States entered World War One because of Jewish influence, because of Jewish newspaper publishers, and their influence within the administration of Woodrow Wilson. You can see also you know, the Federal Reserve, the starting of the Federal Reserve and the income tax, but of course, there was still a lot of it was still possible to resist Jewish power and talk about Jews, and so you did have a backlash. And in the 1920s, you had a very restrictive immigration law that was passed to restrict immigration, and it restricted immigration to most countries, but it was really aimed at Jews, because it was Jews in particular who were creating the problems that this law needed to respond to. But you just see then over the 20th century this gradual increase in Jewish power. World War II became a big propaganda victory for them, and they amplified or exaggerated or whatever this story of the Holocaust, which I wasn't aware of as a kid, but every kid growing up in the United States today would be aware of it. It's been built up so that it plays a bigger role in American society now than it did 50 or 60 years ago, when it was supposedly a much more recent occurrence. And so you've just seen a gradual capturing of the electoral system through donations. And of course, you have a lot of prominent Jewish politicians, but even if a politician's not Jewish, they wind up, almost all of them, wind up coming under a Jewish yoke that, you know, they certainly nobody will speak up against Jewish power. Nobody in American politics, in the electoral system, will speak against Jewish power. Some of them resist, in more subtle ways, but we've really become a Jewish dictatorship. It's a Jewish tyranny that the United States is living under right now, so that, you know, nobody can speak openly about Jewish power without having their lives ruined. And that's where we are today.
Okay, so by going back to what you were saying, is that they actually not infiltrated the government itself, but they rather decided to go for different industries, for example, like newspapers, media.
They went that way first, yeah.
Yeah, to the cultural centers, like, for example, theater, like music, as you were saying, and also they got to banking. Mm. So, three main things. Number one, they need the funding in order to make these operations possible. So they needed to go to banking or anything that was profitable. Mm. Once you make profit, you can actually use that profit to anything that you want. Mm-hmm. So then it's decided to go to number two, which is the shaping the public opinion. Mm-hmm. It's exporting ideas, you know, changing the mindset, the zeitgeist.
Thank you.
So then it's headed to go to number two, which is the shaping the public opinion. Mm-hmm. Exporting ideas, you know, changing the mindset, the zeitgeist of the people, changing their even their worldview, their Weltanschauung, to an extent. Now, of course, it's impossible to completely obliterate the previously existing Weltanschauung, but because there is always something that will remain. But the main issues that they wanted to replace or maybe confuse people, confuse the mindset of the population they are trying to infiltrate, and that's why they needed the propaganda industries, like you were saying, you know, maybe magazines, maybe newspapers, maybe radio, maybe television, something like that. And then that's where they start moving to other things. Then it is where they start moving to the cultural side of things, but most specifically, like you were saying, music and theater, and maybe movies. You know, going back to, you know, moving some years afterwards. Mm-hmm. That's what they start attacking. That so first you need the money, then you need the voice. So to say it's a voice, no? Change the public opinion.
Right.
And then they need. Then is when they start to actually changing the public opinion.
Yeah, there was an article written by a reporter for the Los Angeles Times newspaper named Joel Stein, and he started his article by referring to a public opinion poll that had been taken in 1965. And in 1965, I think it was a majority, over 50% of Americans said that Jews control the media. And then he was referring to another poll that was taken about 40 years later. And it was maybe only 10% or 12% who said that Jews control the media. So the number of people saying that the Jews control the media has gone down sharply. Now it's very few people will say that. And Joel Stein's article started out saying, "I've never been so upset by anything in my entire life. Of course Jews control the media. How could people be so stupid?" Now, maybe he was trying to be funny. He went on to talk about all of the Jewish chairmen and presidents of media companies. He listed them. But the fact is that in those intervening 40 years, it became impossible to talk about Jewish control or domination of the media, of any industry, of retailing. We forgot to mention department stores, but that was a big deal. Academia, campaign finance. You can't talk about these things without risking losing your career and your livelihood. And if nobody's going to talk about it, then how are 50% of the people in America expected to know if you're not allowed to talk about it? And so we've gotten to a point where people understand something is wrong, but because nobody's allowed to talk about what's really the root problem, people are very susceptible to alternative explanations, like Noam Chomsky's type of explanation. Or, okay, there's about another half hour of this interview. If you want to hear it, go to the Patrick Slattery YouTube channel and check out the Zero Schizo video, and go to maybe about minute 45 or 46 to pick it up. We'll be back next week.